Well, good evening, everybody. Good to see you guys. Good to have the Petersons back with us. Woohoo! How was summer up there in the north?
Busy.
Busy, really?
People are there all the time.
Oh, is that right? So that's where we're supposed to be going for vacation and stuff? All right, if everybody's got their Bible with them, if they'd like to open up to 1 Kings chapter 3. Continuing on in our study here. 1 and 2 Kings were all part of one book until the Septuagint, that was the Greek translation of the Old Testament. I should have made that as a question. What is the Septuagint? Greek translation of the Old Testament, and they divided them into two books. So we're looking at the falling action now in Israel after the Golden Age when David was king. In our last chapter, David has expired. We've seen the last of David in this account of him so far. We'll of course be rehearsing all of this again when we get to Chronicles, but David has passed away and he's made his son king. And as we saw last time, David's third born son Adoniah had made a power play. He went and was asking Solomon's mother to give him Abishag the Shunammite as a wife, which we believe was David's concubine. The text doesn't say that, but we infer that. And so for a man to make a play to take the wife of the former king was to actually be an act of treason. It was an attempt on his part to have a future bid towards the throne of Israel. So as Solomon had said before, if this guy turns out to be okay and he doesn't make problems for me, well, he can live. But if he turns out that he's not an okay guy, then he's going to die. And, well, as we saw, he died. And so actually, all through that chapter, Solomon cleans house. He goes in and he puts his brother Adoniah to death. He puts Joab to death. He banishes Abiathar, who was the high priest at that time, banishes him and removes him from office as high priest. And he executes Shimei. Remember the guy that was kicking dust on David and throwing stones at him when David was on the run from Absalom. And so the chapter ends out kind of bringing all of those thoughts to a conclusion by saying that he was secure in his rule, that his throne had been established. And we pointed out that was a lot different from David or Saul before him, that, you know, those guys had to really struggle to secure their kingdom and have something that was a semblance of a secure kingdom or a prosperous kingdom. But Solomon has kind of walked into a turnkey operation, and with just a few little adjustments, now he's in a position where he's very secure in his position as king. So now we begin here, chapter 3, and I just want to read verse 1 to begin with. It says, "Now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he married Pharaoh's daughter. And then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall all around Jerusalem." So we see that he's got these building projects. We see he's got these ambitions of things that he wants to do. We pointed out that when we get to Chronicles, it will be a lot more clear as to what David had instructed Solomon. He instructed him largely about building the temple. So that's one of the major plans that Solomon has for his time as king. But now it mentions here also that he marries the princess of Egypt. He marries the Pharaoh's daughter. This was not an uncommon practice. This was actually, you know, and again, we keep qualifying, and we keep trying to explain over and over again that, remember, this was a different dispensation, and it was a different time period. God's original plan was for a man and a woman to be one flesh, one man, one woman. But he made allowances in the Old Testament, so he didn't come out and condemn multiple marriages. We later learn that, you know, even when as it touched different aspects of human relations and marital relations, Jesus indicated that there was a hardness of the heart before the new covenant had been established, that God was willing to allow for some of these things. So it's not even so much that he's marrying multiple women, but we are seeing the beginning of a trend here in Solomon's life. And he marries this woman from Egypt. And that was, like I said, that was a normal thing. That's how you'd ratify a treaty between neighboring countries, is that you would, you know, present the daughter of a king to either the son of a king or to the king himself. And so that was That was a normal practice. What's interesting here is that Egypt is creating this kind of an alliance with Israel. Egypt was not known for making these kind of alliances because Egypt was a power unto itself. Egypt was a superpower in that region. They didn't have to make any kind of treaties or alliances. They did what they wanted to do. They were Egypt, for crying out loud. Now to all of a sudden see that they're making these sort of treaties with Israel tells us something about Israel. Israel's in a different position altogether now. Israel is somebody to be reckoned with according to the nations. She's elevated now in the sight of the nations around her. Pharaoh, the Egyptian king, is actually going out of his way to make a treaty with Israel, obviously because he needs to feel the security of having some sort of treaty ratified between them. So this is interesting to me. This tells us where Israel is in her history. Definitely in the realm, in the bracket there of the golden age. Now, we believe that Solomon had been married before this woman, because later on when we get to 1 Kings 14, verse 21, it's going to tell us that Rehoboam, Solomon's firstborn, who's going to take the throne, is 41 years old when he takes the throne. And in that same breath, it tells us that Solomon reigned for 40 years. So just a quick little math study, and even I, being remedial in math, can put that together, that he obviously had this child a year before he became king. And so this obviously was a marriage that he had before he had become king. Solomon's marital status, you know, it's just interesting that it starts with this, that they throw this little detail in here. Solomon's marital status is going to be a problem for him. It's going to actually be the cause of some real spiritual undermining that goes on in his life. Nehemiah, actually, later on in Israel's restoration after the Babylonian exile, Nehemiah uses Solomon as an example, rebuking the Israelites because they're marrying women from the neighboring countries. They're marrying women who are pagan, and they're falling into bad practices. And Nehemiah states there in Nehemiah 13, 25 to 27, points out that even though Solomon was greatly loved by the Lord, he says that pagan women caused him to sin. Those are his words, not mine. Pagan women caused him to sin. So obviously, you know, beware them pagan women's. But the real issue here, see, the real issue, and we want to understand what's going on here and what the warnings are really about. Because the core of this is about a divided heart. And what we're seeing here are the beginning stages of a divided heart for Solomon. Even this early on in this, the willingness to do what's necessary in order to secure a secular kingdom is leading him down a pathway that's going to be problematic for him later on. This didn't have to do with gender or race or religion or anything like that, but it had to do with Solomon's state of heart and the divided nature of his heart. This is important to God. And it is important to God. It is important to God who we allow into our hearts. I mean, that actually is. That's why who we're going to marry and what kind of relationships we develop, those are very important issues to God. Those are not secondary things. Those are some of the most important issues that we're going to be wrestling with because God is concerned with who we allow into our hearts and what we allow to have a place in our heart. Those are issues that we're always struggling with. God is looking for our hearts. God is out to capture our hearts. We've said that time and time again. That's what it's all about. He's not looking for little automatons that he can wind up and get to do things for him. He wants a relationship with this human race that he made in his own image. He wants us to love him and to love him wholeheartedly. So that means that the relationships that we develop and the marital relationships that we have are all still going to be within the confines of that relationship that we have with God so that he becomes singular in our hearts, that our worship and our love for God is actually expressed in our love for our spouses. And that's kind of a heady subject to get into on just a little side note, but this is the point that's going on here, that Solomon's heart is divided and we're seeing the actual seeds of that being planted there. All right, verse 2. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Now the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. All right, now the text seems to indicate here that there was no unified worship going on in terms of the sacrifices being made within Israel at that time. They're going to these high places. Obviously, altars have been set up at various hills and high places, mountaintops in the region around that area. And people are going there to offer, we're assuming, making their offerings or sacrifices, burnt offerings to the Lord, to God. And, you know, so that's what we see happening here. But this even in itself is aberrant. Because God's original intention was for Israel to have the tabernacle worship. Remember, that's what he established there. Well, if you don't remember, back in Exodus, when God first established all of these practices and these practices of worship, he set it all within the confines of this tabernacle that they were going to have, where the ark was going to be set, where the altar and the altar of incense and the golden candlestick and the basin and the altar for the burnt offerings to be made on behalf of the nation, et cetera, et cetera. All this was supposed to stay in place. This was mobile stuff. I mean, it was kind of like an RV setup type thing when they were on the road, and they would pack it all up and they would take it with them, and they would unpack it when they got to wherever they were going to be, and they would use it then. And so it was supposed to continue on until the temple was built. But during Saul's reign, when they had taken the ark out onto the battlefield to try to use it as a lucky charm to beat the Philistines actually captured the ark, and we infer from later passages that they went back to where the tabernacle was in Shiloh and destroyed the whole thing, tore it all down. Now, the last we ever see of the tabernacle, we'll find out about it when we get to Chronicles, Saul had set it up in Gibeon. But there's no indication that there was any more altar. There's no indication that any of the other accoutrements of the worship were still in place. And we do know that David took the ark and brought it down to Jerusalem, kind of separated the whole thing and put a tent up for the ark to be able to remain in Jerusalem. So obviously nothing is unified. Everything's kind of scattered around, and people are just kind of doing the best that they can. They're going to this place or that place. They're not exactly sure where to go, but they're going to go offer their offerings to God in these high places. The other thing that's kind of unsettling about that is that these high places were characteristic of pagan worship. The Canaanites that were dwelling in the land before them, that's where they would go, to the high places, and they would offer their offerings to their false gods and their false idols. And so we kind of see, I mean, there are scholars who infer from this a sort of corruption that's taken place in the, obviously there's the corruption of not having the tabernacle, but maybe even more than that, maybe some other infiltration of pagan practices have been added in with the worship of the one true God that the Israelites are trying to do there. That would kind of explain why in verse 3 it says that Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father, and then it says that word except that he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. It's kind of a confusing thing. Scholars aren't exactly sure what to make of that, because it's all in a very positive context, except that it says except. And so we may be inferring from that then that there was this corruption. So Solomon was doing the best that he could, except that he's still following what all the other Israelites are doing and not getting that temple built and centralizing the worship practices of the Israelites of that day. So we could be looking at that corruption to that degree. So it says there, he goes to Gibeon, where the last known place that we know that the tabernacle was, to the high place. So obviously there's a central place that a lot of people like to go to. There's the big altar there. And he goes there and he sacrifices 1,000 burnt offerings at the altar there. I mean, this is like seriously going over the top. I mean, this is huge. And it's indicative of several different things. For one thing, it's indicative of here Solomon at this tender age as he's beginning his reign. There's a real loyalty to God represented in that. I mean, there's extravagance in his desire to please God and do something in worship of God. But it's also indicative of the kind of wealth this kid has inherited. I mean, this is at the beginning of his reign, and he's able to go out and do this much. That's a lot. I mean, this is a lot. We don't even know how long this would take. 1,000 burnt offerings up there, that's just huge. That's incredible what he did in that. But, you know, to his credit, so he's inherited all this. He's come into wealth. To his credit, you know, he's not hoarding things. He's not pulling it all together. He's not thinking, well, how can I, you know, what's the least I can get away with here and still be okay with this God of my father or anything like that. We do recognize here, there's something in Solomon's heart. You know, he's extravagant in his desire to give back to God what he believes that God has given to him in this. So that's kind of a cool aspect of what's happening here in Solomon's life and reaction of worship. Verse 5. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" And Solomon said, You've shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You've continued his great kind. You've continued this great kindness for him, and you've given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord, my God, you've made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child. I don't know how to go out or come in. Your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? Okay, so God comes to Solomon, and he comes to him in a dream to communicate something to him. And, you know, we see that all through Scripture. We believe that God oftentimes communicates to us in dreams. There's all kinds of theories as to why God would do things this way. One of the ones that I hold to is that that's usually the only time he can trust us, when we're asleep. You know, it's kind of like he's a nice guy when he's asleep. When Abraham, you know, was going to have a covenant cut between him and God, the first thing that God did in that whole thing was put Abraham to sleep. Got to get you out of the way. Okay, now we can move on and I can do all this here that's necessary. So, you know, I think that's part of it. But there's also, it takes a lot of faith to believe that God has spoken to us in a dream, because dreams are weird. I mean, you know, how many have had weird dreams before in their life? I mean, how do you discern? How do you know? I mean, it really requires that we step out and believe that the Lord has really done something, that God's actually spoken to something. I mean, Solomon has this dream, and it's a, you know, some people could look at it and say, well, you know, that sounds really nice. God's asking you, you know, you can have whatever you want. That's nice for you, Solomon. That's a great dream. I think I'll have a dream like that. Solomon has to believe this. Solomon has to look back on that and think about that. You know, was that the garlic and onion pita I had just before bed? What was that? What happened there? And he has to discern in that. He's got to sort through it and make a decision. I mean, he's got to make a decision about life based on something that happened to him while he was asleep. And we, like I said, we know all kinds of crazy things happen to us when we're asleep in our dreams. But it's interesting that God, when he appears to Solomon, and he appears to him in this dream, because honestly, wouldn't you feel like you could trust it a lot easier if it was like an open-eyed vision? You're walking down the street, and then, boom, here's God in front of you speaking to you. You could walk away from that and say, wow, you know, I think that was God. But something like this, you really got to think it through. You got to wonder about this. And there's all kinds of things that are going to be coming into play. And so when God appears to Solomon, and he speaks this word to him, it's really interesting, because it almost seems so open-ended in its statement. I mean, what shall I give you? You know, what do you want? What shall I give you? He's just putting it out before him. Ask of me. And I think there's something significant in that, because, you know, even though God is asking this, God also knows all things. That's one of the attributes of his character. I mean, he knows the end from the beginning. He's timeless. He's outside of time. He knows exactly what's going to happen here. And I believe that in a lot of ways, what is happening is that God, by this very question, is providing a test for Solomon. Not a test for God to figure out what's going on with Solomon, but for Solomon to be able to see what's going on with his own heart, with his own life. The very thing that's put before him is meant by God to actually shape him. The very proposal that God makes to him, God is going to use to shape something in Solomon's character. And when you think about that, then you forecast ahead and you go over there to where Jesus was speaking to his disciples and speaking to us, and he was making statements like, ask what you will of the Father and it will be given to you. What an open-ended thing to say. Mark 11:24, you know, whatever things you ask, believe you have received, you'll have them. I mean, those are remarkable open-ended kind of statements to make, you know, promises to make. And then when we look at this and realize what God is doing through those things, we realize then that this is a means. The very promise itself becomes a test for us to kind of discern what's going on in our own hearts. The very promise itself, the very proposal that God makes, God's going to use to shape us and reveal some things that are happening there. It's marvelous the way he works. And I love what's happening here with Solomon. And so Solomon responds firstly, and I love this, he first responds with gratitude. He doesn't even answer the question, you know, initially. Paul, God says to him, you know, what do you want? What can I do for you? And Solomon doesn't come back on, well, you know, I would like to be popular with the ladies, and I'd like to, you know, go with all the list of things that he wants or whatever. He doesn't do anything like that. Immediately, as soon as God says to him, what'll I do for you? Immediately, Solomon shoots back with, man, you have been so good to me, God. You've been good to my father before me. You've been faithful to him. You walked with him. You did all of this, and now you're doing this for me. And so immediately, the first thing that shoots out of Solomon's heart is gratitude to God for what he's already done. Not about what God is going to do, but what God's already done. There might even be a key to something in that for us, to realize something about our own hearts when it comes to the things that we look to God for answers on, we look to God for his help on. Part of us needs to rise up in gratitude, not stress so much about what it is that we need, but be in gratitude for what he's already done. I mean, when we think about our lives and think about who we are and in the dispensation that we live in, the knowledge that when we leave this place, we're going to a far better place, that we have eternity with a Father who loves us, who has our best in mind in all things. Man, thank you, God, for that already. Now we'll move on to these other things that are going on here, but thank you so much for what you've already done. And that's what Solomon does here. And then in humility, he's honest about himself before God. He doesn't start listing off his own attributes, saying, well, you know, it's good that you asked to do something for me, God, because I really deserve this. I really think that this is a good plan on your part, and this will help you along the way. You know, he's honest about himself, and he says to him right off the bat, he goes, you know what, God, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm a little child, and he's not really a little child. He's not a little kid, but he's using that as a metaphor to try to express his woeful inadequacy for the task that's in front of him. Saying, I'm like a little kid. I don't know, you know, I don't have enough sense to know when to come in or go out. I don't know what I'm doing here, and how am I going to take on this task of leading your people? And so this is good because it provides for us a kind of a clue too, as well. Well, that's redundant all the way around. It provides us a clue as to what true humility is like. True humility is not self-derisive. In other words, Solomon doesn't just say, you know what, I'm just like a little kid, I'm worthless, I'm hopeless, forget this whole thing. God, just go away, leave me alone because I can't do anything and I'm not able to, and I'm not good enough, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's owning his own inadequacy, but he's not living out of that. And you know, a lot of times we make a big deal about that. We talk about here about how, you know, we're not good at this. When it comes to being a Christian, We're gonna own that. We're gonna realize that. I am not good at this. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I don't do this well. The things that I want to do, that I should be doing, that I don't do them well. And the things that I shouldn't be doing, I'm just amazingly good at, and I do them all the time. And so we own that. We realize that. I am inadequate on this, but I'm not gonna live out of that. I'm not gonna live out of that. Solomon owns his inadequacy, but he does not live out of it. He doesn't say, so I can't do anything. He just says, so here's what I need. We're inadequate. As Christians, man, we don't do this well. Who's going to say that they do? We don't do this well, but we're not going to live out of that. We're going to live out of his enabling. God makes us able. I can't do this on my own, and I screw up all the time. Yes, yes, you do, Rob. But I'm going to trust you that you will enable me. You will give me what I need. You will change my heart. You will alter me as I go along, as I seek to do what it is you want. Yes, yes, Rob, I'll do that too. So we own the reality of who we are. We're honest with God, and we're honest with ourselves. God, I don't have this together. I'm not going to try to kid you, and you know I don't have it together. But you can change me. You can alter me. You can help me. You can enable me to live differently than the way I always used to live. And that's what's happening here. So real humility will own it and be honest about it, but not live out of it, not just resign ourselves to some fatalistic idea that things will never change with me, I'll never get any better. Because where we're unable, God is able. With man, it's impossible, but with God, all things are. You know, I rarely ever do that kind of stuff, but it was kind of fun. I liked hearing it every once in a while. Caught you off guard, is that what you said? Everybody's going, what? Was that Rob? Where's Rob? Okay, so anyway, now I'm all embarrassed. I'll try to not blush. Let's see. Okay, so he's asking then, so what he asks God for is enlightenment. He says, God, I want an understanding. And I love this. He's not just asking for knowledge. He doesn't just say, I need more knowledge to know how to do this. And you realize that we as Western people, this is what we crave all the time. We're always running around looking for knowledge. We want to, we want to be able to understand a situation. We want to have all the pieces together so we can try to work these things out and get it all together on our own. But that's not what Solomon's asking for. Solomon is not asking for knowledge. Solomon is asking for wisdom. He's asking for an understanding heart. He wants to be able to perceive and be able to discern between right and wrong. Literally, in the Hebrew, that word understanding means a hearing heart. I want to have a hearing heart. In other words, I want to be able to hear you. I want to know your wisdom in this. I want to know your perspective, your viewpoint of things, so that I can follow that and do what's right. See, this is what God does. God is good, and he's the source of all good, and his purpose is to train us in goodness. He's leading us into goodness, and this is what Solomon is asking. Asking for here. I want to know your goodness. I want to know how to operate and choose and make decisions in my life that are in harmony with who you are and what your character is like. That's his, he's looking for godly enlightenment. And he wants this not for himself so that I can be really cool and so that everybody will appreciate me and see how important I am, but he says, I want to do this for the people of Israel. I want to do it for your people. I want to do it for the nation that you've chosen, that belong to you. I want to be able to serve others in the process of this. So this is for the sake of God's people. So he's already demonstrating that he's got wisdom in buckets that he's desiring right off the bat to serve others and not to just serve his own needs. That's the heart of love, when we're others-centered and not self-centered. That's when things begin to open up and real life begins to unfold in front of us. Okay, you're probably getting nervous thinking, how are we going to get through this chapter? Okay, verse 10. The speech pleased the Lord, and Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you've asked this thing and have not asked for long life for yourself, nor asked for riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies. God, please kill all my enemies. But have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I've done according to your words. See, I've given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any be like you arise after you. And I've also given you what you've not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. So if you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. Then Solomon awoke, and indeed it had been a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, offered up burnt offerings, offered peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. So God was pleased with him. Now, this doesn't mean that God suddenly loved Solomon now because he said these things, but when it says that the Lord is pleased this way, we don't want to take that to mean that, we don't want to go around on the opposite side of that and think that God is mad at us if we're doing things wrong. It's not that. It's just the same concept of being in harmony with his character. This pleased the Lord. This is like, yes, this is who I am. This is wonderful. This is my character as well. So we're in harmony here. So, this is what God is doing in his life. And God highlights the fact that riches and honor were not part of his request. He said, since you didn't ask me for all of these things, you didn't immediately go down the list of all the things that you want for yourself and all the things that you've been desiring for yourself, then God goes on and does exceedingly abundantly more than he had asked or thought. And as Jesus states in Matthew 6:33, that if we seek first the will of God, the values of God, the kingdom of God, then all of these other things that everybody else is seeking for in life will be added to us. Now, but we need to understand that, in this case, for Solomon, who was a king of Israel, and in that time and in that region and for that space of time, it was important for Solomon to have the riches and the honor that were going to be there for the sake of God's future plans for Israel. But this does not mean that in every case and for every person that God is about ready to make everybody rich. I just don't believe that. And even Jesus, when he uses this concept and he's talking about how our Father will provide for our needs, he points out that Solomon, he uses Solomon as an example, and he said, you know, think about how God cares for birds and he cares for flowers, and even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these flowers. Well, he's talking about the way God is able to provide for the very needs that we have. So I don't, you know, I don't think that we're going to walk away from this saying, yeah, this is cool. As long as I ask for stuff like knowledge and, you know, other stuff like that, then I'll be rich. You know, obviously we've indicated something's wrong there anyway, and so it kind of undermines the whole purpose. But we can trust that God will provide for us. God will take care of our needs. God looks after us just like he looks after all that he loves. We can trust him for that. And so then, you know, he gives this promise to him, and he talks about how his kingdom is going to be great. Now, what's interesting is on a secular level, on a nationalistic level, Solomon's kingdom is great. I mean, it will be unrivaled throughout Israel's history. But on a spiritual level, we're never going to come back to the days of King David until, of course, the King of Kings arrives on the scene and comes to inaugurate the kingdom of God on earth through Jesus Christ. But for David, you know, David's relationship and his heart after God, we'll never see that again. Not on that level as we saw with him. Now, Solomon will rise to amazing power. He'll be meteoric in his rise and astounding in his wisdom, but we're not going to ever see the kind of intimacy that we saw between God, the sweet psalmist of Israel, and God. And so, you know, it's an interesting thing. There's kind of a trade-off in this, and again, we're going to begin a real roller coaster ride as we go through the history of Israel's kings. In verse 15, then it says that Solomon awoke and it had been a dream. Now, again, I come back to this. This is an amazing thing to me. Solomon has got to go and act on this dream. Solomon had a dream, you know, and now he's got to wake up from that dream and go out and act on that. Now, when I say act on it, there's really nothing that he's going to do. It's not like he's going to go, you know, immediately try out for Jeopardy or something, because now I'm really smart and I can, you know, win all the answers or something like that. But I'm saying that he's got to go out and trust that the Lord is doing something here. And so he's really basically just got to go out and rule. He's got to go out and do what he knows he's been commissioned to do anyway. And if the Lord has spoken to him in this dream, then it will unfold and it will happen as he said. But you know, to me, I don't know. That just seems like that would be a hard thing. There would be a little bit of trepidation in me anyway. I know that there have been many times in my life where I believe the Lord has spoken to me in a dream. This very church came out of an experience like that. But there was nothing that I could do. I mean, you just have to, and even to this day, you know, years afterwards, and the Lord has put things into place, you still kind of look back at that and think, you know, was that really God, or what was that? So it's a hard thing. You put the human element on that with Solomon and realize that there's more to this. You know, these weren't just characters in literature somewhere. These weren't just imaginary, fictitious characters that were plot devices somehow. These were real men and women who had to really struggle through these things and think about what it was. But look what God is able to do when we will make ourselves available, when we will trust that he is at work in some ways in our lives, that he does guide and he does lead us, even though we don't fully understand, even though sometimes it there's a lot of trepidation in stepping out on what it is that we think he may be doing. But we can't ever go wrong stepping out and making ourselves available to God. I just can't see how we could ever go wrong making ourselves available and allowing the Lord to work through us and do the stuff that he wants to do. Okay, don't get nervous, because we'll get through this last part really fast here. Verse 16. Now two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And one woman said, "Oh my lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. And then it happened the third day after I had given birth that this woman also gave birth, and we were together. No one was with us in the house except the two of us in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from my side while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead child in my bosom. And when I arose in the morning to nurse my son, there he was, dead. But when I had examined him in the morning, indeed he was not my son whom I had born." Then the other woman said, "No, but the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. And the first woman said, no, but the dead one is your son and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. Okay, here's our problem. This is going to be an example of Solomon's great wisdom on display here. So here's an example of something that was going on where Solomon came in and displayed his ability now to be able to discern between good and evil, between what was right and what was wrong. Does anything jump out at you at all in this little bit of text, just right near the beginning as we're looking at it? What? Anything? Okay, well, yeah, that's true. You know, there's an example that pops up right away. But when I read this text, does it seem strange to anybody that a couple of harlots are standing in an audience with the king of Israel? This is a king in all his splendor. Nobody's got riches and power like this king before. And what is the case that he's trying? You would think, well, you know, harlots, no, that's, I got assistants who cover all that kind of stuff. I don't mess with it. Now the term harlots, prostitutes, it literally means that they're prostitutes, or it could mean that they're just promiscuous women. Either way, you're not talking about dignitaries. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, ambassadors from some other country came and were asking Solomon for some wisdom. No, a couple of harlots out on the street have this terrible situation that has arisen between them. Some terrible evil is being promoted here. And Solomon, King Solomon, takes his time to look at that, to look at the lowliest of people. I mean, they're single women, obviously, and so going to the king for his judgment. So they are the lowest on the strata that you could find within that society at that time in that region. And here is Solomon, the king, in all his splendor, listening to their complaint, to discern for them. I think that it's an amazing thing. Right off the bat, when we see a display of Solomon's wisdom, we see his heart towards the lowest. We see his heart towards those who would be marginalized in any other circumstance, to those who are in need, and he gives them an ear. Man, if that's not a characteristic of God, what is? I mean, that's our God. That's an example of the kind of love that he has for us. He comes to us. He cares for us. There's no one who's out of his reach. There's no one who's too far gone for his ear to hear their cry and to listen to them. To me, that's the first display of amazing wisdom and harmony with the heart of God, that he's even hearing their case. And so the case that they present to him is a case that's impossible to solve. I mean, there's just no way. There's no witnesses. Way before they can do any kind of, you know, genetic testing or anything like that to find a DNA or a sample or anything like that. There's just their word against each other. It's her word against my word. No one else was there. No one else could have seen it. So how are you going to decide? Who's telling the truth? How are you going to know who to make this decision for? It's an impossible situation. So what does Solomon do? Verse 23. And the king says, the one says, this is my son who lives, and your son is the dead one. And the other says, no, but your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one. And then the king said, okay, bring me a sword. So they went and brought a sword before the king. And the king said, okay, divide the living child in two, then give half to one and half to the other. There. And the woman whose son was living spoke to the king, for she yearned with compassion for her son. And she said, oh, my Lord, give her the living child and by no means kill him. But the other said, yeah, no, let him neither be mine nor yours, but divide him, yeah. So the king said, give the first woman the living child and by no means kill him. She's the mother. And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. Okay, so Solomon's great wisdom on display here. His answer to this impossible dilemma is the words, bring me a sword. That to me seems like a strange thing to begin. You know, those aren't usually those words that begin a sentence. When you start a sentence, bring me a sword, usually terrible things are going to follow after that. It's usually not smart stuff. It's usually, you know, a lot of bloody terrible stuff. This could have been construed as reckless. And yet the wisdom of it was soon to be seen. The wisdom of it was going to be seen after the thing played out just a little bit farther. And you know, I'll tell you, I think about this when we see that God is giving Solomon of his wisdom and showing, kind of pulling back the curtain just a little bit to reveal his own ways of doing things, how God is at work in things. How many times in our lives have we been asking the Lord for something that we need help with? We see a problem, there's a dilemma here, and we're calling out to the Lord, and we feel like that the first things out of his mouth is kind of like, bring me a sword. Something that seems absolutely incredibly out of character with what it is we need. We ask him for some help. There's a financial problem going on. And what happens? Well, it just gets a little worse. Thank you. It's one of those things that we look at it and we think, does he really even care? Does he even know what's going on? We look at Solomon. Are you out of your mind? You're talking about this terrible act of this atrocious act of violence against some innocent little child. Are you crazy? And yet he was far from crazy. It was his wisdom on display. We've got to remember that when it comes to God dealing in our lives. We've got to remember that just because we're quick to assign how this is going to work, we're quick to explain to God how it needs to happen and exactly what needs to fall into place, we've got to remember his wisdom is going to be at work. And sometimes it's going to look crazy to us. Sometimes we're going to look at it and just think, well, that's it. There is no God. This can't be. This can't possibly be. And yet all through it, it's God's wisdom. And so many times, haven't there been times in our lives when in hindsight we look back and say, I get it now. And we feel like idiots because we see what he was doing, but we couldn't see it at the moment. And we've got to realize that. We can save ourselves a lot of heartache. We really can. And that's what this is all about. It's not like, you know, we got to get it together now before God gets mad. It's not that. It's that we can save ourselves a lot of heartache because there's a lot of times we're just thrashing around on the floor, just screaming and having fits because we can't figure out what God is trying to do. But God in his wisdom knows what he's doing. And if we can learn to still ourselves, we can save ourselves a lot of agony. We can be still, and know that he's God. He's God, and he's good, and he's strong, and he's loving, and he's out for our best. And that's what Solomon. Solomon was out for the best possible solution in this situation. Bring me a sword sounded terrible. But when his wisdom was revealed, then it all made sense. And so, you know, of course, what happens here, we see that when he proposes a split decision for this kid, the true parental relationship is revealed. And how is it revealed? By her sacrificial love. She's immediately willing to live her life without him as long as he's kept safe. She's willing to sacrifice herself in the midst of this. The other woman, nah. Whatever. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's neither of us have him if that's the way it's going to be. There was no love in that. You see, and that's the whole, boy, that's the characteristic of love that's revealed all through the Bible from beginning to end. We cannot escape it and we must learn it because the world around us has taught us a completely different kind of love. The world around us has taught us this terrible, terrible, cheap imitation thing that's not love at all. But it's all about what's going to make us feel good and provide what we think we need. It has nothing to do with the love that's revealed through God, which is self-sacrificial. How can I serve you? What can I do? How can I live for you? That's the concept behind love. That's real love. And it's that on display that renders Solomon's wise decision. He says right away, oh, well, now I know who the parent is. The parent is the one who loves. That's obvious and evident through her willingness to care for his needs above her own. And so those are things to learn. So he's able to spot the real mom. He rewards her accordingly, according to the love that she's displaying there. So the lesson that we learn out of that is that love wins. Love always is going to win. To love sacrificially, to love with all our hearts, it'll always win, no matter what we may see at the moment. It'll always win. So the story of this gets out and everybody, and it's a curious thing that they fear Solomon. That doesn't mean that everybody, you know, is running around holding their heads screaming because they're afraid of Solomon, but it means that they revere him. They look at him and realize this guy's smart, and he's smart like God's smart. And so he's somebody that we need to pay attention to and listen to what he has to say. It's the kind of fear that it talks about, that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Not fear like we are afraid of God, but to recognize that there is a God and he's not me. And I am accountable to him in some degree. And you know, and then from that we come to the realization that his love is great, his grace is present, and his willingness to save is without boundary. So, Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for Solomon's wisdom. We thank you for what we see in that and how your heart gets revealed in that. And I just pray, Lord, that you lead us into that same kind of harmony with your character that you led Solomon into. For our sakes, Lord, for the sake of your kingdom, lead us into that kind of harmony with who you are. And I pray that for each and every one of us here tonight. And I trust you for it. In Jesus' name, amen.